Well, the Pentagon is working on using remote-controlled sharks, that's right, sharks, as stealth spies. Engineers funded by the military have created a neural implant designed to enable a shark's brain signals to be manipulated remotely. Sounds almost like Manchurian Candidate. They may do it to people soon. The Pentagon hopes to exploit sharks' natural ability to glide quietly through the water, sense delicate electrical gradients, and follow chemical trails, according to New Science magazine. The project, funded by DARPA, was presented at the Ocean Sciences meeting in Honolulu. Neural implants consist of a series of electrodes that are embedded into the animal's brain, which can then be used to stimulate various functional areas. It's going to happen with people, too. In a moment, Charles R. Smith, our guest, we're going to talk about new technology. We're going to talk about the situation with the United Arab Emirates and their quest to take over U.S. ports and some other issues on Coast to Coast AM. Cyber war columnist Charles R. Smith, one of America's leading experts on cyber technology and its implications for war, terrorism, privacy, and every way that technology interacts with our lives. He is an exclusive columnist for Newsmax.com as its cyber war expert and currently president and CEO of Soft War, his own consulting company. He's our guest on Coast to Coast, Charles R. Smith. Hey, Charles, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Tell me about Soft War, by the way. I've never really talked with you about that. What do you do?
I basically provide internet security. We established a record of utilizing encryption for a variety of communication techniques, whether it be something as simple as either email or chat. At the other end of this, we also use it for e-business applications such as digital books or digital picture type of systems. And at the other end of that, I actually go on site and will customize certain security features in order to lock out people that you don't want to not be able to view or access data. Hackers have a tendency to even get beyond firewalls and antivirus features, but encryption stops them dead. They just kind of look at it and walk away. And not only is it the unprofessional, just sitting there, criminal-type hacker, even the professional and the governmental or even military hackers. So we've actually provided some systems at the other end of this with our government and corporate users, customized applications, again, that allow them to secure their data so nobody but they can get to it.
What does a hacker really want, Charles, with just us? You know, we're not the Pentagon. We're just, you know, we're at home. Maybe we pay our bills over the internet and things like that. Do we really risk a hacker getting information on us?
There is some risk. The typical hacker will actually not necessarily utilize the capability of getting information off of your system, although if they find something of interest or worthwhile, they will certainly seek it out, such as credit cards, social security numbers, tax information, even name and address can be bad enough. The flip side of that is they like to make use of your machines. Hackers will establish control links into your machines, download software onto your machine to make use of it to send out either more spam bots or robots software that they like to utilize to try to take over systems. Spam bots are very popular these days. You can make a lot of money sending out spam, but you don't want to have it tracked back to you in particular.
Oh, I see.
So okay, they'll take over your machine, turn it into their own slave, and actually make use of your accounts and your systems, and you may not even know it until somebody starts complaining, saying, look, you're sending out lots and lots of spam. And at that point, you need to go into your system and clean it up.
I saw a story a few months ago where some people now are actually putting in this false ATM system into an ATM, and then they hook up their own little camera so they can see you, you know, put your PIN number in. Is that real, or is that a hoax?
That's happened several times.
It is going on. Okay.
Yes, there are a number of different types of scams that run along in this fashion. I think the last one that was very well documented was down in the University of Texas. The hackers, or in this case, scam artists, actually erected a fake ATM, had people walk up to it. They would photograph them swiping their card and entering their PIN number. Of course, they would never get anything out of it. It would just come up and say that, I'm sorry, the system is down. You'll have to try again later
right.
at some point.
After they got your information, though, right?
Right. And, of course, you can easily purchase a card swiper, have it hooked up to your own software to peel the data down off of the magnetic stripe, which is your account info, your expiration info. And as long as they get your PIN number, they've got it made. And generally what they will do is they'll set up with a long-range camera, usually from a covert location, an apartment or a building facing down where they just can't miss, and watch you key in your PIN number.
Oh, my gosh. And now what do they do about the ATM card? Do you need that? Do they make those up later?
They can either make them up later, or they can just utilize the data straight up and virtually key it in to get a credit card processor to operate. There are two ways of operating a credit card or ATM card. One is by utilizing the magnetic stripe. Another way is to actually key in the appropriate information. They call that manual operation. And again, a credit card processor is just going to recognize it as a valid card as long as they've got your PIN number. One of the other ones actually recorded your PIN number. As you entered it, it would record it along with your card data onto their hard drive, and they just come back later and dump off the data. They have a bunch of credit cards or debit cards and the PIN numbers to go with it, and they're on their way.
So I guess the best advice here, Charles, monitor your accounts, check the internet, and just keep an eye on your own personal business.
Keep a very close eye on your account. If you see anything suspicious, report it immediately. Do not, under any circumstances, respond to an email that says, I need your credit card or debit card with the PIN number, and the bank is saying that there's something wrong with your account. If you need to talk to your bank about your account, pick up the telephone, call your bank. Don't worry too much about the telephone security. The NSA's got plenty of credit cards. They've got access to all your U.S. tax dollars, so they could care less about your money. The flip side to that is a hacker who just loves to send out these little spam emails, which says, oh, we have a problem with your account, and we need you to send us your account information so we can do a verification or go to this specific website
Do
a verification. Now, I've signed on before to banking accounts which have secured internet encryption. Once again, those are legitimate accounts. Only use those. Use them sparingly. Very rarely do I use my credit card over the internet. I would generally recommend if you see an 800 toll-free number, pick up the phone, call up the merchant, say, this is what I want, and give them that information in that fashion, because, again, hackers just love sitting back there with these little easy spam bots. This is where, again, we were talking about bots.
Yeah.
There is the phishing as well as keyboard loggers. These are spy bots. Essentially, a hacker will set up his own computer that will search out computers with security weakness. He will just sit back and relax while his computer automatically finds as many computers as possible and downloads its own little special watch program. And when you sit down and key in your credit card information, it will alert master with your credit card information. You may be actually going to a legitimate site, buying a legitimate item with a legitimate card, but someone else might be watching that transaction in its entirety.
That's amazing. That technology is getting too good, Charles.
Well, it's always been a fight, offensive and defensive. The defensive guys haven't had a lot of chance until recent years when we started switching to encrypted packages. And that has finally given us actually the edge over the offensive attackers. The flip side of that is that if somebody installs a piece of software to log the information on your computer, it doesn't matter how good your encryption is, it's logging the information right there as you're keying it. And again, that's where your antivirus and anti-spy bot software comes into play, Norton and McAfee being the two big leaders. I always recommend to anyone who's touring the net, get yourself an antivirus package, get yourself a firewall. That way you can see anything that's running on your system and you can prevent anything from attacking your system. And the reason why I recommend both those kinds of packages is simply the antivirus package will cure what ails you. A firewall will tell you when something is trying to communicate with the net. And if you don't want it to talk to the net, you can say, no, I don't want it to talk. You may have if someone actually downloads a spy bot on your system and the firewall catches it saying, okay, this thing is trying to talk out, you can say no, and that spy bot may still be there, but it can't talk the master. It's just as good as if it never was installed.
Our nighttime producer, Tom, told me tonight, and I don't believe this, and I'm glad you're on tonight. He said that your computer can still get viruses if it's not on, but the internet is plugged into it. I don't think that's possible, is it?
The system needs to be running at some point in order for it to obtain a virus. However, the most dangerous thing, the 9 times out of 10 when I get called to a friend's house or to a client's place, it's because they did not install the appropriate defensive software and they have either DSL or cable. And they don't quite understand that when you have DSL or cable, it's always on. Meaning once you got the DSL or cable modem running, you're on the net, you're linked. And again, there are robot programs that are going out there. This is just like that old robot program from War Games with Matthew Broderick.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It dials up every number on the net looking for vulnerable systems. And it just continuously keeps going. And when it finds one, it'll report back to master or it'll give him a list. The same thing applies here with the net, and what we're looking at here essentially is that when you're on a DSL or cable modem, once you turn your machine on, it's connected, and it's connected at high speed, so a attacker can come in and grab a hold of your system and start downloading things before you can say Jack Robinson. Or, you know, Dick Cheney or anything like that.
Yeah.
You get shot, okay? Big and bad. Dial-ups aren't as bad. And the reason for that is that every time you dial up, you actually get a different number assigned to you. Usually a DSL or a cable modem, once you're assigned a number, you pretty much stay with it. So they will come back to your address and attack your number every time. So, once again, the DSL, especially DSL and cable modem people, or anyone that is directly connected to the net, the new satellite networks are going to have the same vulnerability. If you're directly connected to the net, you must have a firewall and an antivirus package. You may want to also go with a piece of hardware called a firewall as well, especially if you're networked to other systems like small businesses. And the only reason, again, for all of this equipment is to keep somebody off of your system that you don't want in there. If you're running a wireless network, again, you're vulnerable unless you provide the appropriate wireless network security. And the reason why I say that is I know guys who will run around town with a modified coffee can as an antenna, and they can sit 300, 400 yards away in their van with a laptop and log into your wireless network, watch what you're doing, how you're communicating, and make use of your network for their own internet touring and activities.
You got to be kidding. They sit in the van, they've got this coffee can antenna, and they're monitoring what you do?
Oh, yeah. The wireless networks, you're talking about radio.
Yeah.
Okay, if you don't encrypt a wireless network, and again, we come back to my favorite word, encryption here, if you don't scramble it with a code key, a guy with an appropriate machine and the right receiver antenna and hardware can actually detect what you're doing, watch your activity as it's being transmitted back and forth, as well as log into your network and begin to make use of it. If you're connected to the net, he can go on the net using your name. He can watch you sending email. He can steal your addresses. He could even start logging into your systems, actually look at your hard drives, modify things, run programs. You may not even know he's there after about 20 seconds if you're not quick enough. If you leave your network in a vulnerable state, and believe me, when I mean by coffee can antenna, I'm not kidding. The guys out there's several designs on the net. I've actually sat around and tested, worked out with some of these designs, compared them to commercial antennas that you could buy at $400 or $500. And you take a big can of chock full of nuts, empty it out, put in the receiver in the back end of it, and it works just as good as a $600 antenna.
And so what happens if we don't have to worry about hackers, Charles, but maybe Big Brother wants to do the exact same thing and spy on Americans and try to figure out what everybody's doing and looking at? Is that possible? Of course, they've got the great equipment, don't they?
Yeah, the NSA can reach out and watch, as well as the FBI with their CyberKnight programs, and they do that at your ISP. You don't even see it at your end. Your internet service provider, which is sort of like going to the telephone service that you work with and saying, I want to listen in on their phone conversations. So they don't necessarily mess at the individual machine level unless they have to. The real problem, and I think both the federal government as well as many of the major corporations are finally coming to grips with this, is the adoption of wireless networks because of a distributed system. If you've got, you may have a requirement to set up a lot of wireless networks. If you don't provide the appropriate security, people can get in at the corporate level. You can get in and start viewing the corporation's computers. You can get in proprietary data. You can start controlling things. And this is where we start talking about hackers and going into the borderline terrorist and military operations. If there are no appropriate security measures at, say, a water facility, a chemical plant,
right?
You can get in the chemical plant, you can get in on their computers, you can alter valve settings, you can cause disruption as well as destruction physically. Even the power grid has its own separate vulnerability. The industrial applications are called SCADAs. Essentially, what they are is a lobotomized modem with a wireless feature.
I'm still convinced, Charles, when all those states went down, when the power grid went down a few years ago, I still think somebody hacked into it. I really do.
Well, that is a good possibility, but it would have been only a practice hack.
Yes, I agree.
A real good example of an accident that turned out to be reality was the Air Force ran electronic warfare tests from one of their planes and managed to pull down part of the power grid out west. And it was just because the electronic warfare officer turned the volume up on his electronic warfare package.
Hey, Charles, when we come back, I want to talk with you a little bit more about that, get your take on this remote-controlled shark to see if they could do it with people, and then we'll talk about Dubai ports. I'm George Norrie, Charles R. Smith, our guest. Take a look at his website, softwar.net. His book is called Deception. Well, that song sounds like a promo for the After Dark newsletter, doesn't it? Where you get 14 issues for the price of 12 now. It comes in full color. It is a great edition. Guest hosts will write articles. I write an editorial every month. Lex writes articles. Dr. Sky does. Everybody. Richard C. Hoagland did one. Just take advantage of it and pick up the After Dark newsletter by calling 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505, or you can go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Charles R. Smith. Charles, you were telling us about this accident in taking down part of the grid. Why don't you tell us about it again?
This was basically during one of the Air Force electronic warfare exercises, usually known as Green Flag. It is corresponds to the red flag exercises that occur out west. The aircraft in question actually has been since retired, but that doesn't mean that the capability doesn't exist on the newer machines. It was the EF-111 Raven, which is a variant of the bomber version of the F-111 that they use strictly for electronic warfare. And the EW officer accidentally turned up the gain, essentially the transmission power, on one of his EW packages. What it basically did was it reached into a power grid, caused an overload, which brought down part of the power grid, and I believe it was Nevada and California. It was about a 200-mile radius, and you just have to keep in mind that it's my understanding that the officer was actually only using about 10% of the real power of that machinery. You can imagine what kind of power those things can put out if they are allowed to use them in a wartime scenario. That's where we have to look at the kind of systems that we are employing today, and in particular, the F-22 Raptor is now equipped with a specialized radar called AESE.
What does that do, Charles?
The radar system can be used in the classic sense as a radar for targeting and tracking. It can also be used for communications purposes, and it can be used as an electronic warfare device, including the capability of information warfare. The AESE radar is really nothing more than a grid of microwave transmitter receivers that have been miniaturized down to a chip size. So you're not just looking at one transmitter, but you're looking at thousands in this little plane array. And the AESE radar can be used in the classic sense, just like the guy with the coffee can. They can log into computer systems. They can take control of the computer, download viruses, insert spyware. This is designed for operations against, say, enemy surface-to-air and surface-to-surface command and control networks in the military sense, but you could also use it against commercial networks.
That's right.
Or even individual computer sites. If there is a weakness, and you don't even have to have a wireless transmitter for the AESE radar to work, you have a vulnerability access point, meaning that the radar itself can detect and receive information even from an exposed wire or an unshielded system, they can actually log in by remote and force your computer to do things you don't want it to do. And it's only going to get better. The AESE radar systems that are installed in the F-22 are very powerful. You will see them in the F-18 and the F-15 later variants. They're already proposing utilizing a much larger version of the AESE radar on the surveillance aircraft that they're planning on deploying in the near future, such as the E-8. There is one other advantage to the AESE radar. It can also be used as a weapon in itself because the output power of this array of microwave chips that they have put together is and has already been proven to be powerful enough to overload electronics that are exposed. They have actually used it to knock down missiles in flight. This is not the classic, like, laser beam or Star Wars blaster style where the thing just blows apart. Literally, what happens is it will reach into the electronic control systems of a missile, such as the gyroscope, the computerized chip operations, the tracking systems, guidance, and it will cause overloads on the chip at the chip level of electricity, and it will disable essentially all the electronic gear on board. At that point, the missile now becomes a flying lump out of control and generally crashes. The reality of the situation is this appears to be far more effective against air-to-air and air-to-surface, like cruise missiles. The reasoning for that is that those missile systems have to be built with very thin skins to save weight. We're not quite sure how effective it will be against ballistic missiles with warheads in flight. A ballistic missile reentry vehicle is generally a lot heavier and much, much heavier in the shielding category because they have to operate in a nuclear warfare environment.
Charles, so, go ahead.
To give you the concept here, they do think that it may be applicable to a ballistic missile as well, but you're going to have a much more powerful radar to do this.
Story I had on at the top of the hour about the Pentagon working on using remote-controlled sharks as stealth spies by implanting neural implants in the shark's brain. When are they going to start doing that to human beings and start trying to control them, much like the Manchurian candidate?
Well, I hate to break it to you, it's already happened.
Oh, no.
Well, the problem here is that humans in the sense of direct mind control by implanting chips into your brain, that is somewhat of a difficult operation. There are, on the other hand, people that require this kind of chip control, such as epileptics, where they want to have the chip switch on and stop them from having a very dangerous seizure. That has already been applied in medical science. It is something that we're going to see more of. I mean, look at Dick Cheney, where you have a chip on board, and if he has a heart attack, it will automatically invoke the defibrillator on board, and suddenly his pacemaker will start operating that he's got implanted under his skin. So we are becoming more cyborg-like in that we are adding on these little electronic features, especially when the medical condition requires it. In order to get a chip implanted, you've got to know about it. It's not something that you're going to swallow in a pill and it'll happen. This is a surgical procedure. Forcing you to do something that you don't want to do is far more difficult. It is easier to train an animal with electronic impulses to do what you want to do. This is closer to a Pavlovian type of training than it is a direct mind control feed, take over your body, take and make you into a walking assassin. One of the reasons why the shark appeals is because they're using this as a training device. Sharks aren't necessarily easy to train. They can go somewhere and do some things that other people cannot do underwater. I don't really know how effective this is going to be because we've already had Flipper working for us for a number of years. The dolphin community has already contributed a tremendous amount of protection to America that they don't like to tell you about.
Well, that's true. Well, primarily because that dolphin is so loved by everyone.
Well, yeah, you have Flipper, on TV, but you don't really think of them as being drafted and employed and doing things like finding mines at sea or hunting down enemy scuba divers who are intending on becoming either terrorists or planting bombs and mm-hmm. things. We began this experimentation during the Vietnam War with guard dog versions of the dolphins. They were armed essentially with a donut with a spike. The spike would have a CO2 cartridge, and it would be extremely sharp. And anything that it stabbed with this 6-foot spike would be filled instantly with CO2 and go to the surface. The dolphins were trained by their users in Vietnam to protect the ports and harbors from scuba divers. They were extremely effective against the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese to the point where the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese refrained from that activity after a couple of successes early on. We deployed the dolphin squads, and they didn't go in the water anymore. Thank you very much indeed. The dolphins were not only effective against the enemy frogmen, they also had a tendency to select out sharks who they don't like, and they would go put the spike on. They put their nose through the donut with the spike on it, and they'd run out and snag the shark. Again, that's their natural enemy, and it was just their natural instinct to use whatever weapon training they had.
Sure.
The dolphins are still employed today. I have seen them deployed out of Hawaii. They have gone to the Persian Gulf. These guys don't go down to sea mines and plant explosives. What they do is they find the mine, they identify it for our frogmen, who will then go down and do the dangerous activity. And I hate to say this, the real reason why they don't use the dolphin for the dangerous side of it is because these guys are so expensive, it's a lot easier to just send a guy who's scuba dive trained to go down there with the explosives and take care of the problem. Plus, you want to have that human to look at it and go, okay, this is exactly what I need to do to this thing. A dolphin is not necessarily going to be easily trainable to say, to differentiate between this is a sonic mine, this is a radar, a magnetic mine, this is just a regular contact mine, and I need to disable it in different fashions.
Well, I've got to tell you, one of my favorite movies, Jaws, and I'm picturing one of these neural sharks swimming around. Remember the scene when Robert Shaw was trying to wheel in the shark, Jaws, and he's screaming at the other two on the ship, Dreyfus, and the sheriff, and he's basically saying, the taxidermy man's going to have a heart attack when he sees what I bring him. And can you imagine wheeling in one of these sharks that have been remote controlled and trained? I mean, they could be dangerous, couldn't they?
You know, their natural instincts still come into play. They will bite if they feel like it's something edible. Remember, just as Dreyfus pointed out, they do basically three things. They swim, they make little sharks, and they eat. Now, you can train them to do certain aspects like carry surveillance devices or tag certain things. Again, this is kind of like training a dog, a Pavlovian style, and that's what the implant is literally doing. It's giving him positive or negative impulses, generally negative impulses when it doesn't want it to do something, or positive but pleasurable impulses when it does. We can actually go back to other creatures. My favorite has always been the pigeon bomb.
That
was a B.F. Skinner device from World War II that competed with our electronic early radar bomb, guided bomb systems. The idea was to train a pigeon to peck at a display screen with little switches behind it, and the display screen would show the picture of a ship, and as the pigeon pecked at the ship, the bomb, by using the switches, would be guided towards its target. The pigeons were so good at discerning targets by their training method, they were able to tell the difference between two ships in the same class. Pigeons have extremely good eyesight, incredibly good eyesight. B.F. Skinner, of course, also used hemp seeds to train the pigeons this way, rewarding them when they pecked at the right spot. So that actually made them pick at the screen frantically. So they were not only active, but actually a little overactive. Thank you very much indeed. The pigeon bomb never flew, so to speak, because the original BAT, which is a radar-guided electronic bomb, came into existence, and the Navy had a preference for utilizing electronics over something like this. The Coast Guard used pigeons to pick up people in the sea. They would put them in a little dome underneath their C-130 surveillance aircraft to see if they could find survivors. A human being searching over thousands of square miles of oceans, even with a pair of binoculars, is terrible. The pigeon, on the other hand, if you train him to start pecking frantically when he sees an orange life vest, is extremely good. They are that's their job. That's what they have been bred by thousands of years of selective genetic operations by nature to do. The Coast Guard eventually abandoned the project, even though it was extremely successful, basically because of the bad publicity and opposition by people like PETA, who don't particularly like the idea of making a pigeon try to help save human beings.
Well, I got to tell you, Charles, I mean, all this is just fascinating technology that utilizes some things that are low tech, basically, you know, dolphins, sharks, pigeons, and things like that. It's too bad we don't have the kind of technology we need in order to avoid the kind of struggle we're going to have with this Dubai Ports World situation, which during the next 40 days or so, this thing is up for what, review? Do you think this is going to pass or not?
It'll pass.
Hands down?
Hands down. Don't even give it a second thought. It's already a done deal. There are a couple of reasons why. One of the basic reasons why it's a done deal is Dubai Ports winning this contract. Actually, you may find this hard to believe. It's a good thing, because the competitor who was going to buy out this British firm, Hutchison Whampoa.
No, the Chinese?
Right. They were the ones that lost the bid. You know, the ones we wouldn't allow in at the Long Beach port, the big debate that we had over the Panama Canal ports, those were the guys that were competing against Dubai. And again, they lost because the UAE guys decided they were willing to up the bid, and they won. The fact is, and this again goes back to me going through with my intelligence sources, I mean, I have people who work at these facilities who are in charge of port security, not just for single ports, but for whole ports globally. And we're talking about not just in the United States, but around the world at various intelligence agencies. Every last one of these intelligence folks have come back and said, we've worked with Dubai before. They are good folks. They will hire locals to do the work, so they have a vested interest in seeing the security. They do not mess around. These guys are businessmen first. Politics is a secondary issue. And one of the reasons why I can emphasize that politics is secondary, and not one of these facilities have ever told me that the people at Dubai Ports would turn away an Israeli ship.
That's interesting.
Okay, you would think that wouldn't play so well in the Arab world. Well, we don't talk about that a lot. One of the sets of documents that I have about our dealings with the UAE relates directly to that security issue, but I have yet to run into any pundit, anyone that's emailed me, cannot come up with a specific incident where Dubai Ports did not either address the situation immediately or made sure that it would never happen to begin with.
But don't you think this review period, and we're going to take this break, Charles, come right back, this review period is important because maybe this is something that should have been done in the first place. I don't think it was. We'll be right back. Charles R. Smith, our guest on Coast to Coast AM.